Glad you're a part of the class and prepared to talk about the things that pertain to history and geography of the Bible. In our last study, we were talking about the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and how that the world then became somewhat populated as these came out of the ark and came down from Mount Ararat into the valley below, ultimately into the valley of Mesopotamia, southern end of it, the valley of Shinar, as we have been discussing with the attempt to build a tower unto heaven, and God scattering the people as a result of their languages. But we noted that Japheth probably had lived or settled in the upper portion of the what we call Bible area. Yes. Oh. Well, that would work better if I push this button. Thank you, ma'am. I thought you could see what I could see. Does no good to push this if you can't see it. Thank you. It should come right up. Richard was commenting about this new projector, how quickly that it does get on the screen, and how quickly it can go off, too. But, as you look at the upper portion of our map, you'll see the area where Japheth settled, and very likely settled in the his descendants in the Isle of Cyprus, south of Asia. And then, of course, we talked about Ham, how that he played an early role in the history of the Mesopotamian Valley. We even talked about Nimrod, how that he was given credit for establishing what later developed into the Babylonian Empire and reached all the way up into the kingdom that was ruled over by the kings of Assyria, Nineveh being the capital of that, and how that some of these descendants moved down into Ethiopia and Egypt and other areas. And we wanted to make this note, in particular, a descendant of Ham, the fourth son of Ham, Canaan, settled in the land that was identified as Canaan. And Rick, I believe you read, if I'm not mistaken, how that that portion of land would be taken and given to the Israelites, those who had descended through Abraham. And we'll, of course, talk about that more a great deal later, talk about that a great deal a little later in our study, as we see depicted on this map, the places where they settled. And then Shem, part of Shem's descendants, remained in the valley of Mesopotamia while others moved into the area of Arabia. Now, we talked about Elam, Assyria, Babylon, that particular area of the Mesopotamian Valley and north, and we talked about that as all of Semitic origin. These city-states of Aram and the Arabian tribes all fit into this same family grouping descending through through Ham. When we talk about Shem, we want to especially note that the Israelites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, those who settled the portion of land alongside the Jordan River Valley, these descended from Shem. And we're going to study that in a great deal of detail as we talk about Abraham and those who descended from him. And this map simply depicts the regions where the descendants of Shem settled. Now, as we continue on, we looked at this chart, I think, as we were concluding some of the things we were discussing in the class Sunday morning, to note various nationalities that descended from these sons of Shem. Now, you have this in your lesson book on page number 39 at the top of the page. I would like for you to look at that as we pursue our studies, simply to recognize the names of these nations. When you're looking, for example, on the right hand of the chart, your right hand, your left hand, I want you to call attention to Assyria and the Chaldeans, also the Israelites, the Edomites, Moabites, and Ammonites. We've talked about those regions on our map already, generally, as we were doing some introductory remarks studying the land of Palestine itself. But when you look at the center column, the Ethiopians, the Egyptians. These, and of course the Canaanites, the various people who settled there, descending from Ham, and then Japheth on the right-hand side. I want you to look at that line of nationalities that descended that you see in your lesson book on page number 39. Because these are those that Israel interacts with. And we're going to see continued conflict in our study of the history portion of this lesson segment. All right? Any questions or comments just here? I ask you to, on page 39, as we concluded our study Sunday morning, I wanted you to read the last few paragraphs in your lesson book on page 39. Because it depicts for us how that nations begin to rise against nations and cities against cities, and they fought and battled, and somewhat distinctions began to be lost in certain areas. And we want to just briefly mention that. Because of the use of the term Hamitic, those who descended from Ham, and Semitic, those who descended from Shem, take on somewhat new connotations. Japheth's descendants moved in directions away from their brethren, establishing their own cultures and languages. Now, this is a significant point, I think, that clarifies a bit of confusion as far as the history and culture end of the biblical study is concerned. Most of Ham's descendants moved into Africa and developed their own culture and language. However, you remember that list that I called your attention to at the top of page 39, those who descended from Shem. When you look at those who descended from Shem, when you talk about the nation of Assyria, the Elamites, the Babylonians or Chaldeans, and so forth, the Israelites, look further just before the Israelites in that list. You see the Arabian tribes. What we're looking at is the development of various peoples that are not all that far removed as far as geographic locality is concerned. You've got Japheth way up here to the north. You've got Ham way over here in Egypt and Africa and so forth. But now you have all of these who have descended from the lineage of Shem, somewhat in a concentration of relatively short distance. Now, we've talked about the land that was promised to Abraham from the river Euphrates down to the river of Egypt, where the Israelites would dwell, being only 150 miles long and about 75 miles or so wide. And now you have these others that are border with them. Now, what do you think is going to happen to these peoples? What inevitably happens? They begin to mix. Now, one tribe may subdue another, and as you live close together, what sometimes begins to happen is a mixture of culture, a mixture of language, and so the use of the terms Semitic is used then to refer to these common patterns in language and culture rather than to simply identify bloodline. You see the distinction? So when we use the term Semitic in contrast to Hamitic people of Africa, the lineage kind of begins to get lost in culture and language and arts and various and sundry things such as that. And so it's not always used the way that we might like to think that it's used. Now, the reason why that's so important is the text that we looked at where the Canaanites' land would be taken and given to another. It would be given to the Israelites. Well, we think of the Israelites as the only ones who were Semitic. But what do you find out about the Canaanites? They descended from Ham, as you'll look in your list there in the center column. And so what I want you to see is that we have similarities of people based on culture and language that sometimes gets mixed. When we think of Semitic, what do we normally think of? Jews. That's right. But what we see is in this list, it's not just exclusively Jewish, is it? And so we want to simply be reminded of that as we continue through our study. Now, I've said about all I wanted to say on this particular lesson, lesson number 9. If you have a comment or a question, I'd be certainly happy to consider that. But I wanted to say that because I think it clarifies some things for us that may become problematic a little bit further down the line. Any questions or comments? Well, I want you to look on page number 40, and let's consider the promises that were made to Abraham. Often when we engage in a study of the text such as this, we want to identify, and rightly so, the promises made to Abraham as somewhat of the backbone or the theme of the Bible. And indeed, that is so. We want to consider that very carefully. When we look at the promises that were made to Abraham, passage comes to mind. Where are we looking? Genesis 12. Very good. Genesis 12. When we back up behind that to the first redemptive promise, where are we looking? Passage. Genesis 3, verse 15. That's right. Now, Randy, catch me up just a little bit here. You and I were talking a little bit Sunday after class about the listing of the genealogies in Genesis 5, contrasting that to the listing of genealogies found in Genesis chapter 11. And we noted that before the days of the flood, the listing of the genealogies I did not identify correctly. I said that there may be some generations that are skipped in these periods that they are given to provide lineage. They are indeed given to provide lineage, but in the account prior to the flood, tell me what you were saying about that.
I'm just saying prior to the flood, there's an exact number. When the book says it's 1,656 years from creation to the flood.
All right.
And
that's done so because it tells us the number of years old a man was when he had this son, and then identifies that son, the number of years he was when he had this son, and so forth. That's right. So we've got an exact number. Now, that after the days of the flood, what happens? All right, so from beginning to Abraham, we really don't know how long that time was. We can generalize and say about 10 generations, but we can't be specific. Exactly.
Before the flood, they were living up in the 900s quite often.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. I looked for it.
was that there's no record of Methuselah dying. So I think we can assume he died in the flood because he would have been alive he would have been alive up to the flood. And he certainly wasn't on the ark.
Okay. And we know how old he was.
We know how old he was when he died.
Okay. That would be neat. Diana? Well, now you're talking about Genesis chapter, is it chapter 9? Well, the early part of chapter 6. And then in chapter 9, no, not 9, chapter 6, I believe, is where I'm. Yes, chapter 6 it is, verse 3. Yeah. Now, I'll just tell you right straight, I don't know understand all I know about that. There are all kinds of schools of thought. And I don't understand all I know about that. So But we do know that these died in the days of the flood, obviously so, in the sixth chapter. And of course, the definition of a giant, we need to probably talk about that too, not necessarily somebody that's 50 feet tall. But anyhow, with our study tonight, I want to talk with you about these promises that were made to Abraham and a little bit of the history actually prior to that, after the days of the flood. The text that we're going to be looking at, of course, is found in Genesis, and I'd like to suggest, too, that for the next several classes, focus your attention on the reading of the book of Genesis. Read it over and over and over. Lots of good information we're going to be discussing in the class. But when we get to the time of Abraham, again, as Randy has pointed out, I don't know how many years it is after the days of the flood, about 10 generations thereabouts. But there were many people that were living during the time of Abraham. Some have suggested that that by this time we're talking about 2,000 years B.C. and that nations have already arisen and fallen. And that's something I think that is certainly easy for us to see. Others have suggested, and rightly so, that pyramids had already been built. Egypt was being ruled by its 12th dynasty. And what is a dynasty? Pardon me? A bloodline or a family, yes. Be like you become king, and then a son becomes king, and his son becomes king, and his son, and that would constitute a dynasty. But then when someone outside the family conquered that, now we've got the beginning of a new dynasty. And how many dynasties were there in Egypt? We talked about that. There were about 30 dynasties in Egypt. And, of course, we talked about that in the context of trying to determine in what year what event transpired, because it's identified as in the certain year of the reign of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And we know that there were at least 30 dynasties of pharaohs, so we're talking about a whole lot of people. Makes it difficult to come up with the proper numbers. But be that as it may, but there is a lot of history, is the point I'm trying to make, that existed before Abraham. A lot of very important history. And I want you to look at our maps once again, because knowing the places is going to be helpful to us. In your lesson book on page number 40, you're already asked these questions in the beginning of that lesson to identify summer. Where would you put summer? Jenny? Right about there. Yeah, you're good. Just north west of the Persian Gulf there, between the Euphrates River and the Tigris. Where would you put Elam, Lynn? Just up to the right of that, yes. And then if you are looking for Akkad, where would you put that, Chris? Akkad. It would be, that's a hard one for me to remember. Let me go ahead and put it. Right there in the middle of these two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates, where they almost come together. And then the Babylonian Empire is where? Same area, yeah, same area. And we want to remember that because of the greatness of the Babylonian Empire a bit later. The Egyptian Empire, we know where that is, down west of the Sinai Peninsula. And then the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan was the land that was to be promised unto the Israelites. And, of course, we want to familiarize ourselves with that. And in doing so, as we study these maps, we're looking at the seas, right? We can kind of box ourselves in. What's this one up here? Pardon me? Black Sea's here. What's this one? Says Black Sea. Okay. All right. Black Sea there. And then when we look at the land of Mari, is where? Ken? Geography. Where is it?
Somewhere in between north and east, south, and west.
Okay. I tell you what, no comment. Right along the Euphrates River, the land of Mari, and then Nineveh. We want to know where that is and why. It's the capital of Assyria. That's right. the capital of Assyria. That became a threat to the northern 10 tribes and eventually took the northern 10 tribes. Very good. And then identify the Arabian Desert. Where's that at? Right there where it says, Arabian Desert. You're good. Now, why is that so important? So here's the little land of Canaan over here, about 150 miles long, about 75 miles wide. And we have, of course, the sea here. We have the Jordan Valley here. We have mountains that run just west of the Jordan Valley that reach an elevation of about 2,500 feet. And then you plunge into the Jordan Valley to the surface of the Dead Sea at what elevation, Joey? About so. The elevation of the Dead Sea.
It's below sea level by quite a bit. I mean, it's close to 1,000 feet below sea level.
It's just almost 1,300 feet below sea level. Now, the significance of that is when you come up on the Transjordan side, we've got dry, arid country that reaches an elevation of about 3,000 feet. Mount Nebo, for example, was about 3,000 feet. And then just east of that, what do you have? These lava beds. And then, of course, the Arabian Desert. Now, the reason I want you to see how that the land topography changes as you go east is it's going to bring this portion of land into greater significance. But these trade routes that we've been talking about, you see, they really can't go any other place. There's no place else to go. You get into those lava beds and look at the size of them relative to the land of Canaan. The lava beds themselves are as large, perhaps larger, than the land of Canaan. So you're boxed in. This little piece of property right through here becomes prime for the ancient world as far as travel, trade, commerce, wealth. It's all there. And this is the land that God promised to give unto these people. The Ararat Mountains, where are they located? Juan? Right there. Okay, you're good. The Ararat Mountains. Hittite Kingdom. Yes, Joey? Yes.
Yeah, so it wasn't just location that made that such a prized, sought-after area. It was very fertile and would support lots of growth that other areas would.
That's right, and a variety of growth. You know, it's fascinating here where we live in the desert. We look out somewhat south and west of town, and we see that there have been groves of nut trees, orchards, and we see evidence of vineyards, and we see carrots, and we see potatoes, and or not potatoes, but onions, and we see a variety of things that grow here. But you don't have to drive very far at all to find other produce that grows that you cannot grow here. And when you consider the variety of elevation here, you have a variety of things that will grow. You have olive trees. You have various and sundry crops of different types and kinds based on elevation. And you have areas that are more suited for cattle or herds of flocks of sheep and things of this nature. The land flowing with milk and honey. That's right. You've got a great variety of things that take place in this. In fact, this is called the Mesopotamian Valley here. And what is this area called here? The Fertile Crescent. And you see why. You see why. You've got well-watered area here, easy to irrigate. You've got the same thing true here. And you've got the what the Egyptians called the gift of the gods, the River Nile, that provided the luxury for Egypt. But you get very far from the River Nile, and what do you have? You have the same thing over here that you have over here. Barren desert. Yeah. And so topography is one of the things that we want to note. The Hittite kingdom, the kingdom of Aram, of course, we'll be talking about that in the travels of Abraham. The Zagros Mountains, you see where they are. And all of these present somewhat of a box, depending on where you live. Okay? Any questions or comments just here? You see, again, we're laying some groundwork. We're going somewhere with this. Since creation, God blessed the righteous and showed disfavor to the wicked. But God chose one man to fulfill His purpose, and He called his name Abraham. And He told Abram, as he was then called, to leave his family and to go into a land that I will show thee. Now, while you're thinking on that, I want you to open your Bible. Open your Bible to Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11. The latter part of Genesis chapter 11, we read about Terah. And we note there that Terah died in Haran. In verse 1 of chapter 12, it tells us, "Now Jehovah said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house." What relationship was Abraham to Terah?
Son.
That's right. Terah was Abraham's father. Now, when we begin reading in chapter 12, verse 1, "Go into a land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing, and I will bless them that bless thee, and him that curseth thee will I curse, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." I want you to underscore those three verses. I don't know if you write in your Bible or not. I sometimes do, as some of you might know. But if you write in your Bible, you make emphasis on these three verses. Because these three verses contain three promises. What are they? Land, nation, and seed. That's right. Land, nation, and seed. God is going to give unto Abraham a certain land. He's going to make of him a great nation of people. "And in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed." This seed promise becomes the point of emphasis, the theme of the Bible, if you please. The seed promise. But there is a lot of history and a lot of geography that comes to play in bringing that all about. And so the history of the Bible, the geography of the Bible, is important to the development of this seed promise that God made to Abraham. Now, this is the first occurrence of the seed promise that we've seen since where? Genesis 3:15. 10 generations from the beginning to the days of the flood, at least 10 generations from the days of the flood to the days of Abraham, and now we see this mentioned twice. Twice. And it becomes the theme of the Bible. And I want us to be well aware of where it is, what it is, and the development of it. Note, if you will, that Abraham was called to leave Ur of Chaldee. You know, sometimes we look at an Old Testament text and we think that's all the information that we've got on that until we come to some New Testament text that just in a very brief little blip gives us some more information that kind of makes you scratch your head and say, "Well, I didn't think of that." Well, turn, if you will, to Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7. And hold your finger while you're there to Genesis chapter 11 and 12. In Acts chapter 7, reading beginning in verse 2, "And he said, Brethren and fathers, hearken." Context is important. Who's speaking? Stephen is. What's the occasion? He's about to be killed. That's right. In verse 2, as he continues, he said, "The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran." Get that. Where did all this conversation with Abraham begin? In Mesopotamia, in Ur of Chaldee. Look, if you will, verse 3. "And said unto him, Get thee out of thy land and from thy kindred, and come into the land which I will show thee. And he came out," or "then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans, and dwelt in Haran. And from thence, when his father was dead, God removed him into this land wherein ye now dwell." Now, what we're reading in Genesis We read of Terah coming to Haran with Abraham, and Abraham being given these promises. Stephen says that was back in Ur of Chaldee. Now sometimes when we think of a study of an ancient place, ancient characters such as Abraham, we say, well, it wasn't all that big of a deal for Abraham to leave this place to go to a place that God was going to show him. Tell me about Ur of Chaldee. Ur of Chaldee was not an insignificant place. To leave a place like that and to leave the place of your family, that in itself, when we come into the New Testament, into the book of Hebrews, and we read in chapter 11, verses 8 and 9, that by faith Abraham obeyed God to go out into a land which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing whether he went. When we look at that New Testament passage in Hebrews chapter 11, we want to be impressed with not only what God promised to Abraham, but what Abraham left. And Lynn? No. Yes, he was probably as wealthy as any man could become in that era of time. No, no, this was a highly civilized society. Keep in mind that Ur of Chaldee, we're talking about a city, a state of, our book calls it Sumer in the Mesopotamian Valley, a city state. Now, maybe we need to define that. Some of you who are more trained in politics than I am, what is a city state? Well, what did folks do often in those days that we don't do today? They would build a city, build a wall around it, or somehow fortify that city. They would have a king of that city, and it would become its own entity. They would control everything within the walls and as far outside the walls as they could defend. A city state. Yeah, you might have that idea about it, but it was kind of a nice place to be. Ur of Chaldee was that kind of place. It was a nice place to be. And this is where Abraham was told to leave and to go into a place that I will show thee. And he left, not knowing where God was going to take him. Historians have told us that the city-state was estimated in population 250,000 people. When you think of ancient cities, do you often think of that many people gathered together in some kind of a civilized status? Well, they were. In fact, they had an elaborate system of writing. They had an advanced means of mathematical calculations. I understand many of which are still being used today. They also had and have religious records, records that were kept then that I understand some of which are available today. They had a very refined... Our book uses the word specimens of art. I don't necessarily like the use of that word to describe it, but they had a great deal of culture in this area. They had some advanced schools. And so we're not talking about a place that's in the backwoods somewhere that nobody knew anything about. Well-educated, wealthy, civilized people. And Abraham was one of them. Now, when Abraham was called to leave his home, he was leaving something that was very important to him. As we see in Hebrews 11, he obeyed to go out into a place which God had told him, and he knew not where he was going. Didn't know. Now, I want you to open your Bibles there to Hebrews chapter 11, and let's read verse 9. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 9. It tells us that he... became a sojourner in a land of promise, as in a land not his own, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath the foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Did Abraham know anything about a city? He knew anything about a luxurious, fabulous city? Yes, he did. But he left to live in tents. What's the difference between living in something with a foundation and living in a tent? All right.
Headed for some other destination.
Those of us who like to go camping, we know about something of that, especially when we camped in tents. Tent camping is good.
Teach some of the later stuff when we talk about the Israelites living all those years in tents, and all those kids in there most of them have been camping, and I'll say, how long did you go camping for? A few days, and what was that like? And then I say, how would you like a 40-year camping trip?
Yeah.
It's a long time to live in a tent.
It is. Yes. A lot of pleasantries about a tent, but I don't think I'd want to live in one and so forth for that long. That's right. It is. And Abraham looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He looked for something that was permanent based upon what God had promised him. Yeah. Leave everything behind and go. And that's what he did. Yeah, that's what he did. He left his home in obedience to God. We learn that he traveled about 600 miles until he reached Haran. Now, I don't know about you, but a 600-mile trip to me in an air-conditioned automobile is a long way to go. Can you imagine traveling like Abraham did, and traveling 600 miles, not knowing where you're going, just to reach Haran?
And he would have had flocks and servants and all that right with him, right?
Well, you would like to think, yeah.
A small town.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that he took every riches or bit of the riches that he had, but he got up and left.
It wasn't
left his home.
A young kid with a backpack. No.
That is correct.
So it's not like he left a bunch of his stuff behind. It seems like he took quite a bit of it.
Yeah, of course, considering that Lot went with him, and now you've got the productivity of the both of them over this period of time. Yeah, Lot being his nephew. Yeah, exactly. All right. And it would appear that his brother Nahor was traveling along. Our book tells us that he settled in Haran permanently. But I want you to look at this. Just a little bit further, in terms of how far he traveled. In Hebrews 11, he got up and went because God said go. In Genesis chapter 12, we have the command or the promises that are given to him regarding what the prospects are that lie ahead. In verse 4, the text continues there. So Abram went as Jehovah had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. I want you to make note of that. It says, and Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. Now, Jenny, to your point, that does tell us that through this travel of 600 miles. Certainly he left with something, but it has been productive along the way. And so they're on their way now, following the instructions that God has given them. Now, this map shows, of course, the distance, 600 miles, but it's going to be another 400 miles from Haran to go down to Shechem. Look, if you will, again at the text we were just reading in verse 6. It says, "And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem, unto the oak of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And Jehovah appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto Jehovah, who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto the mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he builded an altar unto Jehovah, and called upon the name of Jehovah. And Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was sore in the land." Now, I've got some maps that I want us to look at. I don't know if we'll have time to get to them tonight, but I want you to see the varied distances that Abram has traveled, or the area that he has covered in the land of Canaan. Now, how did he come into the land of Canaan? We've got an idea of the distances now, but as one would travel in those days, and perhaps most any day, you would follow the trade routes. Now, we've identified those already. You remember we've talked about the trade routes on the western side of the Jordan and the trade route on the King's Highway on the eastern side of the Jordan River. But these trade routes that we've talked about, we haven't talked about trade routes that exist up into this area. We've only talked about them from about here down. But I want you to look. Ur of Chaldee, long way to Haran, 600 miles, 400 miles further south until he comes to Shechem. It's likely that he took the King's Highway, get back to this, the King's Highway, because from Damascus it comes down on the eastern side of the Jordan, just south of the Sea of Galilee. We cross over, and here is Shechem, where Abram settled at least for a while when he came into this promised land. Now, I've got a better map of that, if I can get to it here, that will help you, I think, to identify those. Yes, here it is. Now, here's the King's Highway, as we've talked about it, coming from Damascus. But here is the way of Shur, coming up through the hill country of Judea and crossing over right about Shechem is right about there, just south of the Sea of Galilee. I'm sorry, Shechem is right here. I'm pointing at the wrong place. Shechem is right here, crosses over just south of the Sea of Galilee. And then you've got the way of the sea that goes up this way into the plain of Jezreel, and then divides, going off up north and east through Damascus, and then a portion of it going along the side of the Mediterranean Sea here. Now, what I want you to see is that when Abraham came to Damascus from Haran, there's really about three possible ways that you could even consider. Two, of course, would be to come this way, and then here, what to do. He could perhaps go over this way and come in, or, as we've seen here, come across from the King's Highway and then alongside of the Jabbok River over to Shechem, or he could take this trade route, the way of Shur, which would go through Shechem. It's likely that he took this trade route and then traveled along the Jabbok River, crossing the Jordan, and then right over into the area of Shechem. Now, there's the other direction that he could have possibly come following trade routes. Now, on this particular map, we see simply identified these trade routes and the possible ways that he could have traveled. And, of course, here are the promises that God made. The nation, the land, and the seed. And where is that? Yes, Genesis 12. Yes. Lot and Abraham split up. I don't have it on this map. I do have it on a map, I believe, down the pike somewhere. But it was right along here near Hebron. And the decision was made as they were, of course, you know the story, as their flocks and herds were getting so large that they split up and go their separate ways. And, of course, Lot had first choice, and he selected the area, near Sodom and Gomorrah is where he pitched his tent when he saw the well-watered plains of Jordan. And that would place us along and through here. But eventually we note that it is believed that Sodom and Gomorrah are now perhaps buried underneath the southern end of the Dead Sea is where most believe that that is located. But there is a place that we do know exists, and we know where it's located. And I'll find it just in a second. It is the Vale of Siddim at the southern end of the Dead Sea. But that's not what I'm looking for. Hang on just a second. Well, it's just a little bit ahead of where we're studying. Ken, we'll get to it. Let me look at the text very quickly and see if I can find it readily for you. Here it is. The city called Zoar in chapter 19, verse 22. That's where Lot wanted to go, the city of Zoar. And there is evidence as to where that is. And it is at the southern end of the Dead Sea, which would tell us Sodom and Gomorrah had to be nearby. So that would put them at the southern end of the Dead Sea. Also, scholars believe, under the sea currently. Okay? Well, because there hasn't been any evidence as yet found to identify specifically the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, yet when Lot was leaving Sodom and Gomorrah, it was his desire to go to the city called Zoar. As he's fleeing this city to get out of its destruction, and he wants to go to Zoar, it couldn't be 150 miles away. It had to be nearby. So that's the evidence that's used to say, well, Sodom and Gomorrah were nearby. They were near to Zoar. And we know where Zoar is. So as no evidence has been found as yet regarding the identity of Sodom and Gomorrah, then it's likely, it's a supposition, it's likely that it's on the bottom of the ocean or bottom of the sea. Chris and then Lynn. That is correct. It absolutely is. Yes, sir. Yeah. Richard and I were talking about some of this recently when we were looking at some maps on Google Earth. One of the things that it allows you to do, of course, is to look at it today almost. And what you see there at the southern end now of the Dead Sea are salt mines. So whether there is any evidence left would be supposition. Whether it's been mined and destroyed, I mean, there are all kinds of speculations, but that's all that it is speculation. All right. Now, for next time, be sure you continue your reading in the book of Genesis, from Genesis chapter 12 forward, and we'll pick up with these promises that were made to Abraham in Genesis 12 and the following chapters in our study Sunday morning.